The Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder why Christians can't mind their own business. Why should they interfere if a same-sex couple wants to get married? Christians should be rejoicing at the recent Supreme Court decision, live and let live. Oh, my friend, if only it were that simple. I wish with all my heart that it were that simple. Live and let live. Is that the way it's going to be now? Everybody going to live and let live? Sounds great. If it would really happen, are people going to allow the church to live and let live, or are pastors now going to be forced to perform same-sex marriages? I agree with the conventional wisdom, which says that with two consenting adults doing their own bedroom is their own business. But if that's their only concern, why do they keep insisting on bringing the rest of us into their bedroom? And I'm not talking about most gays. I'm talking about the militant, in-your-face gay activists only. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court has overturned or supported the lower courts who had already overturned over 30 states where the people spoke because they thought they lived in a democracy and voted to affirm that marriage is a union between a man and a woman. Is it the job of the Supreme Court to be legislating from the bench? And how will this affect the church? Yes, I've spoken on this subject many times before because I've been warning you for years that this was going to happen. But you didn't really think I'd be silent today after such a monumental ruling just because I've spoken about this before. You didn't really think that, did you? Some review is certainly in order. Now, the majority opinion of the Supreme Court did give a quick obligatory comfort to those concerned about religious freedom. Let me read it to you. Marriage is sacred to those who live by their religions. Traditional marriage has long been held and continues to be held in good faith by reasonable and sincere people here and throughout the world. It must be emphasized that religions and those who adhere to religious doctrines may continue to advocate with utmost sincere conviction that by divine precepts, same-sex marriage should not be condoned. The First Amendment ensures that religious organizations and persons are given proper protection as they seek to teach the principles that are so fulfilling and so central to their lives and faiths and to their own deep aspirations to continue the family structure as they have long revered. The same is true for those who oppose same-sex marriage for other reasons. In turn, those who believe allowing same-sex marriage is proper or indeed essential, whether as a matter of religious conviction or secular belief, may engage those who disagree with their view in an open and searching debate. The Constitution, however, does not permit the state to bar same-sex couples from marriage on the same terms as accorded to couples of the same sex. Okay, now, am I glad that was written? Yes, I am. But all I mean by that is that the road we are on now may be slowed down a bit, but we are in a road without any turns. The road does still exist. And the first people warning us that this obligatory comfort clause is not something to really hang your hat on, the first people warning us about are the four Supreme Court judges who dissented. I'd like to read now a few cautionary quotes from dissenting opinions on religious freedoms. This is from Chief Justice Roberts, and I got to tell you, I didn't think he had it in him after he sold us down the river with the healthcare thing, but he did. He said, respect for sincere religious conviction has led voters and legislators in every state that has adopted same-sex marriage democratically to include accommodations for religious practice. The majority's decision imposing same-sex marriage cannot, of course, create any such accommodations. The majority graciously suggests that religious believers may continue to advocate, quote-unquote, and teach, quote-unquote, their religious views of marriage. The First Amendment guarantees, however, the freedom to exercise religion. Ominously, that is not a word the majority uses. Unfortunately, people of faith can take no comfort in the treatment they receive from the majority today. It is one thing for the majority to conclude that the Constitution protects a right to same-sex marriage. It is something else to portray everyone who does not share the majority's better informed understanding, quote-unquote, as bigoted. Those were the words of Chief Justice Roberts. Also writing a dissenting opinion was Justice Clarence Thomas. He says, the majority's inversion of the original meaning of liberty will likely cause collateral damage to other aspects of our constitutional order that protect liberty. Aside from undermining the political processes that protect our liberty, the majority's decision threatens the religious liberty our nation has long sought to protect. The majority appears unmoved by that inevitability. This was also the concern of Scalia and Alito. They also wrote dissents. Ladies and gentlemen, if even the four dissenting Supreme Court justices see our religious freedom in jeopardy, perhaps we should pay attention. Anyone who's been paying attention to the news these past few years already knew these things before the justices spoke up. Is legalized same-sex marriage the final objective for militant gay activists? Or is it instead another step along the road to eventual silencing of dissenting opinion? Now, I want to be fair here, so I said this for just a second. Let me say it again more clearly. Militant gay activists do not speak for all homosexuals. There are homosexuals who don't agree with this ruling. And even those who agree with this ruling do believe it's wrong to have thought police. Many gay people simply wish to be left alone. Others, such as openly lesbian radio talk show host Tammy Bruce, bravely challenges the militant agenda by writing books called The New Thought Police. Likewise, one conservative radio talk show host like myself cannot claim to speak for all conservatives. But I'll tell you something. If it were a given that legalized gay marriage would settle all remaining legal discussions relating to homosexuality, if I thought the gay community would say, okay, we're square, we've acquired all our rights, thanks, many of us would have less of a problem with it. I would still have concerns. I would still disagree, but I could live with it. Unfortunately, there is little evidence that the militant gay movement plans to embrace legalized marriage as a complete fruition of their goals. The latest sought-after right is only a small part of a much bigger agenda. With each new right, it becomes all the easier to obtain another, much the way fighting for civil unions broke ground for full legal gay marriage in many states. Years ago, we heard, just civil unions! That's all we ask for. We're not even asking for marriage for pizza. Just civil unions. That's all we want. That's what they said. But it wasn't enough. Because when human nature gets a taste of power, it's never enough. This is why it is important to look at more than a few still photos of a movement. We should watch the entire film. The true militant gay agenda is to someday make it against the law to say that homosexuality is wrong, period. Let me say that again. The true militant gay agenda is to someday make it against the law to say that homosexuality is wrong. Do you think I'm being naive? Do you think I'm being extreme? Friend, if you think that, then you have not done your homework. My friend, if you think that, you simply don't know what you're talking about, and you should study more before talking about this issue, because this goal has been openly, shamelessly stated for quite some time. It's nothing even new. I warned people about this decades ago. This is from homosexual spokesperson Jeff Levi in a speech for the National Press Club in Washington way back in the year 1987. And he could not possibly have been more clear. He said, and I quote, "We are no longer seeking just a right to privacy and a protection from wrong. We also have a right, as heterosexual Americans already have, to see government and society affirm our lives." Now, folks, how do you insist that an entire society affirms something without challenging freedom of speech? What about those who cannot in good conscience affirm a homosexual lifestyle for religious or other reasons? When one group of people demands affirmation, how does the First Amendment apply to everybody? Okay, at the moment, legal marriage is one kind of affirmation. Once accomplished, and it's been accomplished now, it only makes sense to insist on other kinds of affirmation. Activists have been smart enough to chip away at the legal and cultural wall one inch at a time. They've been smart enough to boil the frog slowly. Marshall Kirk hammered out a blueprint for his ambitious gay agenda with some co-authors in the late 1980s and early 1990s. The plan was first published as a magazine article and later expanded into a book called After the Ball: How America Will Conquer Its Hatred of Gays in the 1990s. This manifesto was an open, strategic campaign to launch patient, persistent, legal, and media movements. The goal was not only to obtain full legal rights for gays, but to also convince the country that criticism of the homosexual lifestyle is an archaic practice which our country needs to shed. The strategy included lovable gay characters on sitcoms who encounter old-fashioned, narrow-minded friends. These friends end up looking like real idiots by the end of the episode, or they learn a valuable lesson about sensitivity. In a November 1987 article in Guide magazine, Marshall Kirk and Orestes Pill wrote the following. They said, "The visual media, film, and television are plainly the most powerful image makers in Western civilization. The average American household watches over 7 hours of TV daily. Those hours open up a gateway into the private world of straights through which a Trojan horse might be passed." His words. They open up a gateway into the private world of straights through which a Trojan horse might be passed. As far as desensitization is concerned, the medium is the message of normalcy. So far, gay Hollywood has provided our best covert weapon in the battle to desensitize the mainstream. Bit by bit, over the past 10 years, gay characters and gay themes have been introduced into TV programs and films, but this should be just the beginning of a major publicity blitz by gay America. But television was only one of their battlefields. In the midst of debates, the soldiers of this cause were to portray anyone who disagreed with homosexuality as some kind of hate monger. I'm quoting them again. "To be blunt, they must be vilified. We intend to make the anti-gays look so nasty that average Americans will want to disassociate themselves from such types." We'll talk more about this when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net. When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-aged child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
So it's all over. Gay marriage is now legal. That's the end of the conflict. Not so, ladies and gentlemen. This was just the beginning of an agenda that was laid out years ago, of which obtaining the right to be married was only a small part. The goal is to make it against the law to even say that homosexuality is wrong in the church or out of the church, and that is already the law in several countries. It's going to happen here too. Well, I mean, maybe if you pray, maybe if there's a revival, I don't know. But so many churches are compromising these days. I'm not too hopeful of a revival. I talked about Kirk Marshall, or actually Marshall Kirk was his name. Marshall was his first name, who wrote a book called After the Ball, which was kind of a militant gay manifesto. And they talked about how they were going to infiltrate the media. And then right before the break, I talked about how they said they must vilify people. They knew they were going to meet people that say, well, I hate the sin, but I love the sinner. I disagree with the practice of homosexuality, but I love homosexuals. God loves homosexuals. He says, you must paint them as a demon anyway. Let me read that quote again. He says, to be blunt, they must be vilified. We intend to make the anti-gays look so nasty that average Americans will want to disassociate themselves from such types. And it's happening. Can you have a conversation with somebody about this anymore? They accuse you of hate. You know, 10 years ago, would somebody have been accused of hate just because he thought that marriage was between a man and a woman? 5 years ago. But see, again, they boiled the frog slowly. Let me read you another very chilling method that Kirk prescribed in his book After the Ball. He said, our effect is achieved without reference to facts, logic, or proof. Let me say that again. In the militant gay manifesto, they said, our effect is achieved without reference to facts, logic, or proof. I would think that would bother you no matter what you believe. And then they went on through repeated infralogical emotional conditioning. The person's beliefs can be altered whether he is conscious of the attack or not. Indeed, the more he is distracted by even spacious surface arguments, the less conscious he will be of the true nature of the process. In short, jamming succeeds insofar as it inserts even the slightest doubt and shame into the previously held unalloyed beliefs regarding heterosexuality and homosexuality. Such cultural battles go hand in hand, ladies and gentlemen, with supporting legislation. The winds of change are blowing all over the world. All over the world. In Ireland, the Prohibition of Incitement to Hatred Act of 1989 forbids, and I'm quoting, incitement to hatred on account of race, religion, nationality, or sexual orientation. This law includes public speaking, broadcasts, and written materials. Now, one would think that a hateful motive would be in the eye of the beholder, but not in Ireland. Violation of this law includes, as they put it, insulting, and that actual word is used in the language of the law. Similar laws exist in England, Norway, Canada, and Sweden. America is fast on its way to embracing similar legislation under terms such as hate speech and hate crime. Congress passed a Hate Crimes Protective Act in 2009. Since violent crime is already punishable under the law, getting into the head of a person to interpret hate carves a thin line between hate crime legislation and hate speech legislation. Next time, we may just see a law about hate without any other crime. Already long before this week's Supreme Court ruling, back in the year 2012, a judge in New Jersey had ruled against a Christian retreat house that had declined permission for a same-sex civil union ceremony to be conducted on its property. And the reason it was going to be a civil union ceremony is gay marriage wasn't even legal in New Jersey at that time, and the judge still ruled that way. The judge said the Constitution allows, and I'm quoting him, some intrusion into religious freedom to balance other important societal goals. Many argue for same-sex marriage by employing the familiar phrase, separation between church and state. Look, Christians can define marriage any way they want in church, But in secular society, religion cannot dictate to the rest of us. All right? Fair enough. But lately, the separation does not seem to be working both ways. If a judge can rule that a Christian retreat house must accommodate a gay wedding, even in a state like New Jersey, which at that time did not recognize same-sex marriage, just imagine what kinds of lawfuls will unfold now that gay marriage is legally recognized in all 50 states. Rest assured, the right to same-sex marriage is not the only legal battle going on. The right to freedom of speech trails closely behind. Redefining marriage merely paves the way. A Christian baker was successfully sued for refusing to cater a same-sex wedding. A Christian photographer was successfully sued for failing to photograph a gay wedding. eHarmony.com, set up to be a Christian dating service, was commanded by a court to open up a whole section for homosexual couples. That's like telling a Muslim vendor that he has to sell pork, and if he doesn't sell pork, he's discriminating against those who like pork. By the way, although I do think they're going to interfere with the church, don't expect to see anybody go into a mosque and tell them what to do. That won't happen. Nobody's even going to try it because they know that the Muslims won't roll over and play dead like Christians always do. It's happening, folks. The end of religious freedom, all because a few narcissistic judges think they know better than any of the rest of us. Should the Supreme Court be making this decision? Should the Supreme Court be legislating from the bench at all? I remember back in 2009 receiving a comment from an atheist regarding my op-ed piece of December 4th, 2009 for the San Diego Newsroom. In arguing about what our Constitution's Establishment Clause meant, he reacted to my statements about the original intent of our forefathers. I had said what the Constitution meant to them is what the Constitution means, period. My reader responded, "Totally, hopelessly wrong. What the Constitution means is what the Supreme Court says it means, period. Reading the minds of the likes of Thomas Jefferson may be within your abilities, but I'd like to see proof." Now, folks, I hope you're paying serious attention to this. In my article, I mentioned that in the days of our forefathers, religious shrines were all over the public land. That doesn't tell us anything about the minds of the forefathers. Neither do the diaries of the men. It's impossible to know from the actual words of James Madison how he felt, but the often arbitrary, often emotional interpretation of the Supreme Court tells us everything we need to know about Madison and the others. The words of our forefathers and the action of our forefathers do not explain their own words, but the nine justices appointed by politicians with biases and litmus tests do explain their words. To anybody who thinks the Supreme Court has a perfect, exclusively authoritative, unchecked understanding of our Constitution, I have just three words for you. Dred Scott decision, where the wise, insightful legal scholars ruled that African Americans were property. Still care to point to that court as a superior, unquestioned power? Newsflash, nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Supreme Court interprets the Constitution. Nowhere. Don't bother looking. You won't find it. The purpose of the Supreme Court is not to interpret the Constitution. The purpose of the Supreme Court is to enforce the Constitution. In all likelihood, many listeners are raising their eyebrows about now, even fellow conservatives who sympathize with public reaction against judicial activism. Maybe what I'm saying sounds too good to be true or too bizarre to be true. Certainly, this position is out of the mainstream at our present time in history. If you asked most Americans, they would say it is indeed the job of the Supreme Court to interpret our founding documents. So would most lawyers, and certainly a good many judges, yet some legal scholars would agree with me. Others might answer delicately, as law professor and talk show host Hugh Hewitt did when I interviewed him a few years ago. Asked if the Constitution never intended for the Supreme Court to interpret, he answered, "It can be so argued." is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric.
Hi, this is Dana Wright here to announce that Bob Siegel has finally entered the 21st century. It had to happen sooner or later. Now, Bob's popular book, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But, is available in ebook format and can be downloaded to your Kindle or Nook. Whenever Bob speaks, people are eager to purchase this book afterwards. But sometimes parents inform him that their kids will not read anything that they can't put on an e-reader. Well, now that is no longer a problem. So if you want a book that can help everyone in your family offer better answers to good, skeptical questions that people ask about Christianity, go to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com for I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But, by Bob Siegel, now available for download as an ebook.
Most people today believe that it is the job of the Supreme Court to interpret the Constitution, but throughout history, majority opinion has often been wrong. Most people in the world accepted slavery for the greater balance of history, including, once again, the Supreme Court itself, but I won't belabor that point. And so perhaps we would be well served to temporarily ignore public opinion and instead examine the testimony of facts from the past. Certainly, the judges themselves don't mind ignoring public opinion when they want to overturn laws. Got to see the irony of that one. But maybe it's the public opinion which allows the judges to have such power in the first place that should be overturned. The interpretation tradition began when Thomas Jefferson refused to install some justices John Adams had appointed before he left office. Since the judges were never inaugurated, Jefferson didn't feel obligated to use them. His government was sued in a landmark case called Marbury versus Madison in the year 1803. Because this unusual situation had never come up in such a high-level, complicated scenario, litigation turned to the Supreme Court, which ordered Jefferson, via his Secretary of State, James Madison, to appear before them and explain themselves. Jefferson ignored them. Marbury, one of the justices spurned by Jefferson, referred to the Judiciary Act of 1789 as a basis for the court being able to issue such commands. Ironically, the court, after first showing sympathy to Marbury, pronounced a contradictory ruling. It decided that the Judiciary Act was unconstitutional because it gave the Supreme Court more power than the Constitution intended. So even though the justices were sympathetic to Marbury and insisted the law set up by Congress was on his side, they ultimately ruled against him by deeming the same act of Congress to be technically unconstitutional. Marbury, according to the high justices, should have started with a lower court rather than the ultimate court in the land, and therefore they could not issue the verdict that both they and he wanted. This decision was actually a political stroke of genius under the leadership of Chief Justice John Marshall, who found a way to lecture and chastise his rival Jefferson without giving the popular president an actual court order that he would certainly refuse to obey. In short, Marshall devised a clever strategy to save face by having his cake and eating it too. Nevertheless, in calling an act of Congress unconstitutional, even for giving too much power to the court, this landmark ruling established a tradition about the Supreme Court telling us what the Constitution intended. Once again, gotta see the irony. Now, here's the thing. Jefferson disagreed with the court's newfound powers, even though in this particular instance, the ruling was personally convenient, as now he did not have to appoint the judges. Just shows that he's a man who was consistent, regardless of what he personally got out of it. Jefferson feared that if this understanding of judicial power were accepted, it would be, under his words, placing us under the despotism of an oligarchy. Unfortunately, 1803 spawned a custom that we never quite shook. It continued a historical practice called case law as regards our Constitution. And yes, law schools teach and generally accept case law. I am convinced that the case law which grants the Supreme Court this much power is based upon a mistake grandfather clause into a tradition that has taken on a life of its own. Today, we live in the debris of that fateful Marbury versus Madison ruling. Not only the Supreme Court, but other courts along the ladder make decisions to overturn the will of the people or the laws of Congress. California, the state I live in, serves as a great example. Back in 2008, the will of some 7 million Californians was traded in for the opinion of one California judge, one who had a swing vote. Democracy, hard at work. That 7 million opinions not being tolerated for the sake of tolerance. Whatever a person's view of gay marriage, I would think they'd find this a very disturbing trend. I don't mean any disrespect for the honorable profession of magistrates. The Supreme Court is our third branch of government with an important role to play. When unusual situations arise, it falls upon the courts to apply our Constitution. I suppose that that's really what many people mean anyway when they use the word interpret. But it is a false idea that judges can legislate from the bench with unchecked power over the other two branches of government, free to overturn laws at will. Such usurping of authority was the farthest thing from the minds of our forefathers. The Constitution is a clearly written document. It had to be. The authors knew a whole country would be governed by it. They did not wish to confuse us. They did not write in riddles or parables. Neither is it poetry or symbolism. If we know how to read, we do not need anyone to tell us what it means. With all due homage to those who graduated law school, I have a message for everyone else. You do not have to be a lawyer to comprehend the Constitution. Most people will challenge you for having such brass, but Thomas Jefferson will be on record agreeing with you. You're not in bad company. So to those of you who are Christians and you're thinking, okay, Bob, these are depressing times. What can we do about it? Well, obviously, there's no hope in our political system anymore. What you can do, ladies and gentlemen, is pray. And so I'm going to spend the rest of the show talking about prayer. And with that subject, I'm going to do something different. If you are a Christian, you will especially relate to it, but everybody is invited to participate. I'm going to give a lesson about the excuses we make to keep from praying, and the distractions that come our way. Imagine you're playing a board game, one that moves pieces across from start to finish. And imagine that along the way, you're picking various cards with various instructions, much like Monopoly. The rest should explain itself. I hope you enjoy it. This game is based upon the following passage of Scripture. Philippians 4, 6 through 7 says, "Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God, and the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus." So the process, prayer and petition with thanksgiving. The result, peace of God, which passes all understanding. What is a petition? A well-thought-out, well-worded request. We will play the prayer game, updated version, when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Looking for a place where you can be yourself without having to act more spiritual than you really are? Looking for a church where you can have the dynamics of a large worship service, but the intimacy of a small group? Why not try Skyline Church, located in Rancho San Diego by 94 in Hamasha? I know you'll enjoy the preaching of nationally famous speaker, Pastor Jim Garlow. You can also get to know people through a midweek small group. And for those who want to dig deeper into the Bible, a whole series of classes are offered on Sunday mornings. I teach one of them myself, Forbidden Table Talk, same name as my column, a time to bring up any Bible-related question at all. I would love to see you there. Now, I'm not saying Skyline doesn't have other good classes that you could take as an alternative to mine. I'm just saying, don't take any of those. Take Forbidden Table Talk. Actually, you'll enjoy any experience you choose at Skyline Church. Skyline Church, Sunday morning services at 8:30 a.m. and 10:30 a.m. We're about to play the prayer game. The object of the game is to win. No, seriously, the object of the game is to have a quality time of prayer, focused, uninterrupted, which includes petitions and leads to what the Bible calls the peace which passes all understanding. To achieve this goal, one must roll dice, travel across the game board, and eventually reach the peace which passes all understanding square. To start, you may choose the straight and narrow path or the scenic route. Because the straight and narrow path calls for too much discipline and focus, you choose the scenic route. You roll the dice and you roll a three. Move toward the first excuse square. Draw an excuse card. And here's what the excuse card says. I already prayed today at breakfast when I gave thanks for the food, and I really felt close to God at that time. Perhaps that's all the prayer I need today. This excuse leads to conviction, so draw a conviction card. Conviction card says, hey, lame-o, you need the prayer and you know it. Keep rolling, bucko. You roll a seven. This takes you to the instruction square. Draw an instruction card. The instruction card says, take some time today and visit a place of seclusion, a park, a beach, a cathedral, and have a quality time of prayer. You notice that the secluded place square is in the same direction as the peace square. However, your mind is in an excuse mode due to the previous excuse card, which made it harder for the spirit to work in your heart. You must roll a five to get to the secluded place square. You're rolling and you miss it. Instead, you rolled a four. You landed on another excuse square. Take another excuse card. The excuse card says, I'm awfully busy today. I really don't have the time to go to a secluded place, but work is also sacred unto the Lord. And since you used the phrase unto, which sounded so darn spiritual, you feel this was a terrific excuse. Since this is your second excuse, you must receive a penalty. Draw a penalty card. Penalty card says, go back three spaces. You have landed on the barrier reef square. Your excuses and laziness have built a barrier between you and God. A week goes by without prayer. Since you can't go without prayer a week without feeling conviction, draw a conviction card. Conviction card says, your own personal weather report, 50% chance of dark, sinful clouds coming toward your coast off the sea of iniquity. Since nobody likes conviction, draw a conscience searing card. This card will enable you to ignore the conviction. Conscience searing card says, Lord, those clouds don't look so dark to me. Besides, since there's a 50% chance of rain, there is also a 50% chance of a clear day. So what the report is definitely saying is that there's a 50% chance of a clear day. Your response to the conviction involved another penalty. Draw a penalty card. Penalty card says, go to the sea of iniquity. Go directly to the sea of iniquity. Do not pass all understanding. Do not collect peace. The sea of iniquity is hard to get out of. To get out, you must roll doubles. You roll the dice and you don't roll doubles. Sin leads either to conviction or excuse. You will get out during your next turn, and the roll will take you either to a conviction square or an excuse square. Your roll takes you to an excuse square. Draw an excuse card. The excuse card says, define sin. Well, this nutty excuse makes it impossible to take a conviction card for three more turns. Take a numbing card instead and numb yourself to conviction. The numbing card says, life is great. God is on his throne. It seems God had something he wanted to tell me, but I can't remember what it is. Oh, well, it probably wasn't important or he would tell me again. To get out of this numb state, you need the intervention of a third party. You need fellowship and accountability. Take a fellowship card. The fellowship card says the pastor preached about prayer in church. draw a response card. The response card says, "Oh, come off your high horse, Pastor. Wrong response, McFly. Go back to the sea of iniquity. Try to roll doubles to get out. You roll doubles. You land on the instruction square. Take an instruction card. Instruction card says, have a quiet time and have it now. Roll one for obedience square or two for excuse square. And you roll a one. But since it has been so long since you've obeyed your conscience, obedience skills are rusty. You agree to pray, but not effectively. Draw a miserable excuse for a square card. And the miserable excuse for a prayer card says, Lord, bless me this day. Forgive me my sin. Draw a prayer critique card. The prayer critique card says, a little brief, wasn't it? What are the specific sins you're guilty of? Which blessings do you want? You have lost your incentive to cultivate a relationship with God. Draw another excuse card. The excuse card says, gee, I didn't get much out of my quiet time yesterday, so why have one today? This excuse takes you to the square of distraction. Draw a distraction card. Distraction card says, you know, lately, reading Popular Mechanics does more for me than reading the Bible. Well, that distraction takes you back in the direction of the sea of iniquity, but it takes a while to get there. Various excuse squares are landed upon along the way. With each excuse square, you draw an excuse card. First excuse card, you know, sometimes I see more love in the lives of non-believers than Christians. Next excuse card, you know, Christians can be awfully closed-minded at times. Next excuse card. God, you understand my unique personality, my unique weaknesses, and my unique hormones. Basically, you understand that I'm unique. You continue to move in the direction of the sea of iniquity. Fortunately, there is a deliverance square along the way. You land on the deliverance square. You may choose either a fellowship card or a memory card. Also, since you rolled doubles, you may draw two more cards if one doesn't work. You draw a fellowship card. Fellowship card says the importance of obedience is being discussed at church. You don't like the discussion. You exercise your option to draw two more cards. The first is an excuse card. Excuse card says those Christians are always talking about money and always arguing over unimportant matters. Why should I listen to anything they say? This excuse puts you in the direction of the sea of iniquity. But since you were allowed two extra cards, you may now draw a memory card if you so desire. You do not so desire, but something tells you it might be a good idea to draw a memory card anyway. Memory card says you are reminded of what it was like to be close to God, his comfort, his forgiveness. You decide to pray today. You turn around and move in the direction of the peace square. You land on a delay square. Draw a delay card. The delay card says, I'll pray after dinner. Each delay sends you to an additional delay square, earning an additional delay card. First delay card. There's a good movie on TV, and it's a movie with good morals and family values. Surely God will approve. I'll pray later.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out his online column, Forbidden Table Talk, published and hosted weekly by Communities Digital News. Bob is also a regular contributor to San Diego Rostra. We invite you to visit Bob's website at www.bobsiegel.net. You can listen to previous radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and find information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. Bobsiegel.net.
What can we do about the changing times around us? Nothing anymore except pray. Except a lot of Christians find it difficult to have a good quality prayer time, which cultivates the personal relationship they're supposed to have with God. We're having a little fun with this today by illustrating it with the prayer game, where you're moving across the board, rolling dice, and this person was just about to pray, but he drew a series of delay cards. And the first delay card before we went to the break was, there's a good movie on TV, and it's a movie with good morals and family values. Surely God will approve. I'll pray later. Second delay card. I'm awfully tired. I'll pray first thing in the morning so that I may focus with a keen mind and give God the attention he deserves. Third delay card. I overslept. Now I need to hurry to work. I'll pray when I get home this evening, sometime before I go to bed. These excuses put you in a rut. Go to the den of rutness. You must roll doubles to get out of the den of rutness. You don't roll doubles. Draw a rut card. Rut card said, Jesus died for us. We should pray. We should share our faith. Always the same old thing. Been there, done that. Christianity isn't exciting anymore. Christianity to me is, well, it's a big rut. This time you roll doubles. Head toward the peace square. On the way, your weakened rut condition leads you to another excuse square. Draw an excuse card. Excuse card says, God, I'm such a sinner. I don't have a right to pray. Draw a critique card. Critique card says, of course you're a sinner. Of course you don't have a right to pray. Pray anyway. God will accept you anyway. Even though it makes no sense at all, you are seriously thinking of praying, but because of your previous track record, you first decide to take a good detour to the pre-prayer square. Draw a pre-prayer card. And the pre-prayer card says, you make the following pre-prayer prayer. Lord, give me the exact roll of the device of the dice for the prayer square, because I know that the prayer square leads to the peace which passes all understanding square. Well, you get the exact roll needed and land in the prayer square. You confess all your sins. You discuss all your anxieties, job, family, finances, and the world in general. You make requests and petitions. Now you may move into the peace square and receive the peace which passes all understanding. You have won the game. How hard it is sometimes just to have a good, one good quality time of prayer. Well, let's switch gears a little bit. On this show, as you know, I critique many movements. I critique other religions like Islam. To be fair, I'm going to critique the church right now. I went the whole summer of 1980 without attending church. That's right. The whole summer, and I never missed it. A seemingly shameful confession from one who was at that time a seminary student. I won't mention the seminary I attended at the time because I don't want to disgrace them, but it was a Baptist seminary and it was in Denver. Now, wait, before you pray for my soul, hear the reasons. Hear the irony. Ironically, I had in the previous few years developed an extremely high view of church, and it was because of this high view of church that I refused to attend church. Now, I hadn't always had a high view. I was led to Christ in the early 70s when Christians were making an important distinction between attending church and really knowing Jesus. Sure, we still needed some fellowship, but basically the new and cool relationship with God himself was enough. Naturally, it didn't take long for me to fall flat on my face and realize that this relationship doesn't work too well without help from other forgiven sinners. I began studying the New Testament's teaching on the church. I figured there must be some reason why church was talked about so much. As it turned out, I found a lot of reasons, and most of them were issued in the form of commands. There was the command to worship together. There was the command to disciple others. There was the command to hold each other mutually accountable. There was the command to submit to church authorities. There was the command to use our gifts for the betterment of the body. There was the command to reach out to the surrounding community. At the time, I ran a parachurch campus ministry at UC Santa Barbara. For those who need a definition here, parachurch is an invented expression to justify organizations which are church-like, but not church-titled. To their credit, such entities were created to meet a need which the real church had overlooked. Examples are numerous, from Christian Businessmen's Association to Navigators to InterVarsity to Campus Ambassadors, which was the name of my own organization. Now, mind you, Campus Ambassadors was a bit different in that it strongly encouraged church involvement on the part of the discipleship program. And it was part of our discipleship program that our students should go to church. In fact, part of my job was to inform students that simply attending a church on Sunday morning was not enough. One must get authentically and biblically involved. The problem, of course, was that if any of my students ever took this notion seriously, they would be more committed to their churches and less committed to campus ambassadors. A scary idea, since frankly, I needed to keep our ministry going. Besides, if I was doing the job of leading students to Christ and training them in leadership, why should some other organization waltz in and take the bread which they never helped bake? Still, I was conscientious enough to teach on the importance of church involvement, and as part of that teaching, I made it very clear that we, Campus Ambassadors Santa Barbara, were not a church. To my surprise, a student openly disagreed with me right in the middle of my church seminar. He said, "But Bob, all these things you said the church is supposed to do, we do. We have mutual accountability, we worship, we use our gifts, we reach out to our community," and I have to admit, it made me think. I thought about our weekly evening Bible study fellowship time, recalling an observation which I had never paid too much attention to. It occurred to me that if we were meeting on Sunday morning instead of Monday nights, if an organ were being played instead of a guitar, if we were meeting in a chapel instead of my living room, if I were dressed in a suit instead of jeans and a t-shirt, if I were giving my message from a podium rather than a chair, everyone would view us as a church. And yet not one of those visible familiarities is a New Testament test. They are instead optional traditions. I didn't admit it at the time, but the whippersnapper know-it-all student was right, and I was wrong. We have done funny things today with labels. We defend the existence of parachurch groups on the basis that the church isn't getting the job done. Well, if an organization is acting more like a church than the church, maybe it is the church. I don't think I could say that again in one breath. My purpose here is not to get into a lengthy discussion of campus ministry. It's just that my parachurch background was an excellent atmosphere with which to think through the myths and preconceptions we have about Christian community. The New Testament word for church is ecclesia, referring to a called-out assembly of people. It's fitting that the church has a simple definition because it has an important task, and important tasks don't need complication. Our task? To bring people into the family of God and treat them like family. Admittedly, some of the confusion comes from different usages of the term. Church was used in both a universal and a local sense. Universally, it referred to all born-again Christians, past, present, and future. Dead or alive sounds like a wanted poster. Dead or alive, adopted by God as his children, making up a family which is so close positionally that it is viewed by God in a singular sense. For example, Paul called this church the bride of Christ. At the same time, the New Testament referred to local churches. In Acts 14:13, Paul appointed elders in every church. These local assemblies have the same purpose as the larger body, only on a smaller scale. The universal church reaches the world. The local church reaches its neighborhood, or at least starts there. Now, back to the summer of 1980. I was a summer school student living in Santa Barbara for most of the year and living in Denver for only a few months. Fellow campus ambassador staff on a similar schedule seemed to feel that it was proper to attend church on Sunday morning. Campus Ambassadors was an interesting program. If you were a college graduate, they would put you through seminary. So you go to seminary in summertime and you'd have these crash courses. What would have been a 9-week course was crammed into 5 weeks, and it just about killed me. But here I was, I'm in seminary, and in seminary we're learning, we're getting teaching, and then the students are getting together and we're having potlucks and we're praying for each other. And it seemed to me that we were having the church experience every day. So why go to church? For teaching, I have 5 seminary classes. I believe that's enough teaching. Okay, fellowship? But again, the staff were getting together every Wednesday for potluck. Okay, involvement? Well, sure, if there was a church that wanted to trust some new ministry to someone who's only going to be there for a few months, but I had not found such a church. Anyway, I still saw the Rockies that summer. Luckily for me, chipmunks don't sing hymns.
Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.